Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, a panel of authors and educators from Story Studio Chicago discusses the process of writing from multiple identities, often marginalized ones, and inspiring young people to do the same. The writers include Diana Griffin-Jones, Jack Gems, Juan Martinez, and Francis de Pontes Pibulis. The following conversation originally took place May 15th, 2022, and was recorded live at the American Writers Festival.
Welcome. This is the Millennium Park Partner Stage at the American Writers Festival. I'm Linda Dunleavy, Director of Development at the American Writers Museum, and this is our next program sponsored by Story Studio Chicago. A crucial part of the mission of the American Writers Museum involves inspiring the future of great American writing, teaching people to find their own voice and claim authority over their studios, over their stories. It's a mission we share with this program's presenter, Story Studio Chicago. And now I'm going to introduce Rebecca Mackay, Artistic Director of Story Studio Chicago, to introduce our panel. Thank you. Great.
Thank you so much. As she said, I'm Rebecca. I'm an author. I'm also the person who oversees a lot about Story Studio, which is an organization that's been around since 2002. We're located physically in Ravenswood, right off the Irving Park Brown Line stop, but virtually now everywhere. Silver lining of the pandemic. What we are is a studio for people to come and take writing classes of all levels, all lengths of time, all genres, and for every age from middle school to adult. You could think of us as like the old town school of folk music for writing, if that makes sense. A lot of our students are getting published in pretty major ways. Others are just there because it's a hobby. We have everything in between. I felt like it would be obnoxious to foist a thing into everyone's hands, but on the chair by the door, there are a lot of flyers that tell you about Story Studio. If you're here because you're a writer as well as a reader, this is the home for you. This is the place in Chicago. If you are only a reader, we would invite you to join us in those ways too. We have a book club called The Geek Out, where two pretty amazing writers talk about a book they love, a classic, and everyone reads it. So everyone up here on this panel that I'm about to introduce is both a writer and an instructor at Story Studio. So many writers teach as well, not only because it's how we make a living, but because we care deeply about getting stories out of other people, and because we're communicators. That's what we do, and communicating what we do to other people is something we love. So I'm going to start down in the end. That is Juan Martinez. He is the author of the short story collection Best Worst American, but coming in spring of next year, he has his first novel. It's called Extended Stay, and I'm so excited. His work has appeared in literary journals all over the place, McSweeney's, Tri-Quarterly, Conjunctions, if those mean something to you, which they should. He's incredible. He lives in the Chicago suburbs and teaches at Northwestern. Next down the line is Diana Griffin Irons. She is the Director of Diversity and Inclusion for the Second City, U.S. and Canada. You might have heard of the Second City. She's a Second City Detroit alumna with 18-plus years experience as a performer, producer, and facilitator. She has taught tons of workshops at colleges, women's shelters, corporate boardrooms, and is what has, I did not see this, has worked with the United States Embassy in Norway and Latvia, for real, Diana? Oh my God. Introducing improv as a tool for social change. She, for Story Studio, teaches for us a lot, and most recently has been working on our partnership with the Illinois Prison Project, something we're really happy about. Moving down the line, we have Jack Gems, who used to live here in Chicago, and we lost her, maybe temporarily, I don't know, we can convince her to move back to San Diego. But Jack is the author of the novels Total Work of Art, My Only Wife, and The Grip of It, and the short story collections A Different Bed Every Time and False Bingo, winner of the Chicago Review of Books Award for Fiction and finalist for the Story Prize, and she teaches creative writing at UC San Diego. And finally, moderating our panel is Francis de Pontes Pibulis, who is the author of the award-winning novels The Seamstress and The Air You Breathe. She's a 2020 Creative Writing Fellow in Literature from the National Endowment for the Arts. A native of Pernambuco, Brazil, she holds an MFA from the Iowa Writers' Workshop. Her stories have appeared all over, and she also teaches for us regularly. I know that they're going to be talking both about writing and maybe reaching other younger writers, newer writers, in the way that they can. And I'm really excited to hear what they have to say. I'm just going to get out of here and hand it off. Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you so much to the American Writers Festival for having all of us. And thank you all for being here. It's a glorious day, and you're in here talking and thinking and about writing. So we really appreciate you being here. So this panel is called Crossing Borders. And I was thinking about that a lot, and I was thinking that a border is kind of, in my mind, like a demarcation or a fixed line or kind of an arbitrary boundary, that once you cross it, you're in settled in another place and kind of fixed there. And I think that all three of you, your work kind of defies that limitation. And when I thought about it, I thought about, in Brazil, we have this god of the crossroads named Exu, and he's kind of a gatekeeper to the spirit world, right? And he lives at the crossroads. He's this trickster, he's a shaman, he takes many forms, and he offers choices and possibilities to humankind. So to get anywhere, to any of the deities above him, you have to go through him, and you have to step into this crossroads of this intersection, right, of many things. And it can be really scary because it's a place of uncertainty, but also a place of great possibility. And that's how I think of the work of these three authors and improv facilitators. So I wanted to start off by asking you, what crossroads or intersections are you asking us to stand in when we experience your work? Jacques, do you want to start?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. That's such a, I love that as a place to start. So I feel like there are a few different ways that I can answer that question. Like, I think that the most obvious answer that comes to my mind is that each story, each writing project, each book for me ends up being something so totally different from the last thing. Like, I have a historical fiction book coming out next year, but my last novel was a haunted house horror novel. And before that, it was a sort of lyrical, fragmented narrative, domestic story of a marriage. And then each of my stories, you know, that are even more wildly different from one another in their own right, too. But then I also started out as a poet. I still write poetry sometimes. I write creative nonfiction too. I've started doing some screenwriting as well. So it's like, that's the easiest way to answer that question. But then the other thing that comes to mind for me is thinking about the way that that I hope that, and the reason that that's, the reason that each of the projects is different is because when I start out writing, I don't know what it's going to be. And so opening myself up to, you know, moving through that kind of trickster gatekeeper and letting myself follow whatever path seems of most interest or seems like it has is most alive with energy, like that's the thing that I love most about the writing process, right, is letting myself just figure out where I am or where I've traveled to, and then working with that, what's ended up on the page. But the other thing that it makes me think about is the way that that I hope that every individual reader is also invited into a totally individual and different experience in their own right. And so when I'm composing my work, I think about reader agency and leaving a certain level of openness to the narrative that invites the reader to fill in gaps and imagine their own interpretation of the story and their own understanding and think about, you know, what is going unsaid. So that they and that they're projecting into as they're reading, and sometimes that's very frustrating for readers because readers sometimes really like to have all the answers. But that's something that that I'm always thinking about, and so those are kind of the two different levels that I respond to that question on.
It's wonderful. I just want to make one correction. I'm the longtime former director at Second City after 21 years, but I wanted to focus more on writing and teaching. So I'm so delighted to be in the space to teach more and write more. When I think of border, I think of the internal borders and limitation that exist inside all of us. And a lot of my work I've taken into spaces with women, with prisoners, with corporate professionals, with young adult at-risk teens. And I just think there's just so much to unlock inside of us. I think that the border exists internally inside of us as human beings, and that we're always trying to break free out of something, the label, the identity, the role. And we all have so many different roles, and that in itself is a border, if you will. You know, mother, actor, daughter, improviser, and then having to cross over from that role, having to cross over the border of that to, you know, it's like, okay, I don't have my mommy hat on today. I have my writer hat on today, and I have my teacher hat on today. And so I think of border as the internal borders that we have.
Yeah. Kelly, I was going to begin with something else, but like what you just said reminded me that it is weird, right? Like that the borders always imply like this binary, right? You're like on one side of it, you're one thing, and then you move over, cross the border, and then you become something, expected to become something else entirely.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the stuff that happens with, like at least my own writing, is my inability to successfully make that crossing cleanly, I guess is what I would say. But what I was going to say before you you pointed that out is I was born in Colombia, and I didn't really fully move to the U.S. until I was 16. So for me, like the idea of crossing borders has been a very literal meaning of like, oh, I'm a Colombian citizen living in the U.S., or I'm an international student living in the U.S., or I'm somebody who's been living in the U.S. for too long and now talks with a funny accent in Spanish when I go back to Colombia, right? So that created its own weird crisis. But then the other strange border for me is that I grew up loving, like a lot of kids do, and like science fiction and fantasy and horror. Those were like my first and still probably like most powerful reading experiences were the ones that I was having when I was 11 or 12 and reading, you know, Peter Straub or Stephen King or those guys. And so when I went and studied writing at school, you sort of learn very quickly that that's not the writing you're supposed to be doing, and it took me a moment to get back to it, sort of like acknowledge that you can do all of it, right? That you can go from stuff that has a lot of severed heads to stuff that still has a lot of severed heads, but is, you know, also long paragraphs. I don't know. Like that's nice. So that's the other way that I think about like borders, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Deanna, I wanted to talk to you in your work. I watched your TED Talk, and you talked a lot about surrendering to the moment, tricking the brain to turn the ego off, and to trust your own instincts. And I felt like so much of that was about us giving ourselves permission to do what we need to do as artists and as people. And so I want to know, what permission did you have to give yourself to do the work that you do?
Oh my goodness. I had to say yes to myself. I've been a yeser, a pleaser type gal, and I'll always be the yes pleaser. But that's a good thing if you use it positively, and have boundaries, personal boundaries, where, you know, yes, to yourself and to the healthy risk in your life, and learning, saying yes is also saying no to the things that may impede upon your time of the work that you really want to do. So permission has been a huge navigating what is the yes for my moment, for my life, that's going to elevate me, that's going to allow me to grow, and being okay with saying no. And in my 20s, I had a hard time saying no, and so it took me off my path into other directions where I had to like figure out, where am I going? What the hell is going on? Oh my goodness. And so permission is huge. And I think in that it's permission to fail. And permission to fail, to know that I get to make all of these mistakes, and that making the mistakes is part of the success and part of the process, and not judging myself in that way. So that's been huge for me. So I hope that answers.
Yeah, definitely. That's great. Mm-hmm. So Jack and Juan, so Jack, in The Grip of It, your narrators are kind of caught in a small town and in a house, which are kind of very traditional places, right? And in Juan, I read the preliminary report on the conditions of the camps, and it's this wonderful short story that's set, it's kind of a newsletter. It's in the form of a newsletter, a corporate newsletter from the future. And so I think, in my interpretation, both of you play with this idea of the terrifying horror of like the everyday in things. And so can you speak about that intersection of like the everyday and terror, and what inspires you about that?
It's a really, really good question. And one way that I'll, this is like a very weird way of answering that question first, but I love haunted horror novels in general, just when something is wrong with a house, that is something that I adore. I mean, Shirley Jackson is one of those people who just is just hugely formative for me. And, you know, I read Jack Jenks In the Grip of It right around the same time I read Daniel Kellerman's You Should Have Left. So I was like, oh, this is great. And I had never lived in a house before, but we bought one this year. And then I realized, oh no, it's legitimately horrifying, right? It's a legitimately a horrifying thing because A, you're responsible for everything, and everything is falling apart immediately. Like there's, or everything could fall apart immediately, right? So there's, and I realized that that's sort of like a slight terror that is there in late capitalism with everything. It's like everything is this promise that everything's gonna be okay, right? This surface is gonna be gleaming, you know, gorgeous. Everything is, but it's like literally falling apart. You're, you know, like as the moment that you're, even as you're staring at it, right? So that is, I think, the disconnect that I try to articulate sometimes in that, and that comes with language too, especially with corporate language. When you try to, in that story, it's a cultural affairs attaché for a camp that's supposed to be a work camp, but it becomes increasingly horrifyingly clear that it's basically a concentration camp. And horrible things are going on, and this narrator is trying to insist on the fact that everything's okay when things are literally, there's gigantic bugs that are falling out of the sky while he's saying everything's fine.
I agree. At the time that I wrote the group of it, I also, well, I still have not owned a home. I own a condo now, but a home is a different thing. It's like, because you have land. If there's something about land that seems extra terrifying to me. I mean, I could explain, but yeah. who owns land and who can stake that sort of claim? Talking about why a haunted house is sort of like the house that you live in becoming the site of terror is it goes back to Freud, right, and his idea of the uncanny, which translates to literally in the German unheimlich is unhomely. And so that idea of the familiar being made strange and like the house is the perfect container for that. And so in that book, you know, the other thing that's being made strange is that there's a married couple that is slowly realizing that like their grip or like view on reality is very different from one another. So that's, you know, the house that they're living in is becoming unfamiliar and terrifying to them, but it's also that their relationship with one another is becoming troubled. And so, taking this sort of metaphorical house and then showing, and this is a thing that I've returned to over and over again in my work, is that, and I didn't know that I was returning to it for a long time, but then you realize you just keep writing the same thing over and over again in different forms, is this idea that no matter how well you know another person, there's always going to be like that, even if it keeps getting smaller, that little bit of space between you where you can't know everything that's going on in their mind or in, you know, what has changed their mind from the last time you saw them. And so that, like, that feels like the ultimate border or boundary to me, is that, like, you know, you can have, you can be so intimate with another person, but there's still a space.
Going back to something Deanna said, is there, about the labels that we place on ourselves or the borders that we kind of impose on ourselves, or that maybe a culture has imposed on us and then it becomes ingrained in us, whether we know it or not, yeah. And then we realize it. Is there a work of writing or a work of art that has allowed you to see that and release you from that? This is for all three of you, but we can start with Deanna.
Oh, wow. You know, I read... I had a moment where I spent a bit of time in a jail. I also taught the women in jail, and I read many, many books, from Taoism to spiritual books, to Tony Robbins, Awaken the Giant Within, to the Quran, to the Bible, and I also read a lot of poetry, and I'm trying to think if there was a specific book. Well, my childhood book, I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings, always... Yeah. comes back to me as the core book, and I have this affinity for birds. Oh man, I'm a birder. I'm an amateur birder. Last summer there were, and here's a tangent. I'm deviating from this, but last summer there were like 5 blue jays that came into our backyard, and I caught a picture of it. And the cardinals, and there's like little finches and yellow birds. And so there's just something about that book, I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings. Yeah. Birds that are all around us, and this idea of freedom and how the birds come in and out of our lives and our spaces, and if we recognize that. Well, during this time I was incarcerated, I would see these birds, and they would come in. I would count how many that would come in through the door, and I would write them down. I just started paying attention to nature and how nature was starting to speak to me and inform me. And that kind of opened more of my spirituality, mm-hmm. that helped with my writing, that helped to, overcome the label. And in that particular environment, it was a huge label. You're this, you're this, you're this, you're this. You know, you go into different institutions and you have a label that's attached to you. Sometimes it's around gender, it's around race, it's around economic status, and then sometimes it's because of a crime, and you are, you know, connected with something, and all of a sudden you have a label. And so I had to find ways to overcome this imposed label that was put on me, because it's like, I'm not that, you know, that label, you know. And so that was huge for me.
Yeah. Thank you.
There's a bunch for me of writers who have done that. But I can definitely point to like somebody who's like ridiculously formative in a bunch of different ways. And when I was a teenager, still sort of like navigating going between Colombia and the States, I was living in Bogota, had dropped out of college, I was writing for an English language newspaper. And there was this lending library where you could just, like, it was run out of a church by a bunch of American expats. And you could, like, I think you paid like 5,000 pesos, which is nothing, and then you could check out whatever for like the whole year. And I discovered Nabokov there, like mm-hmm. Vladimir Nabokov. And he was, it might have been Penin, it might have been Pale Fire, but, you know, it was the idea of the exile, right? Like that you have. You have a homeland that you can never get back to again. And I had never, it's a very weird place to sort of find a connection, mm-hmm. but it was there. It's like, oh yeah, that's why we keep moving out of Colombia, right? Like we, you know, because it's not steady, yeah. right? So he was definitely that author for me, and I remain very, very grateful to his work for that reason.
I think I blacked out when you asked the question. You said a formative writer?
Formative writer or art that has, if you have kind of created limits or borders within yourself,
yeah.
What kind of released you from that? Or just the writer that you
know. No. So I feel like I remember there are a number of different writers that occupy this position for me, but I remember my parents were very permissive as far as what I could watch or what I could read. Like, they didn't really question what I was into, you know? I feel really lucky that, like, there were times where I felt like I was being sneaky with the way that I was consuming literature. You know, like, I remember, like, my family, sometimes we'd, like, go to Barnes & Noble on a Saturday or something, and it was like, you can pick up work. And I'd, like, test my limits. I'd be like, Eric Bogosian's Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, you know? And my mom would be like, I'm like, it's a play. And my mom was like, okay, fine. Like, I don't know, like, I feel like they were always just like, okay, if you're reading, that's fine. Whatever you want to read, like, just do it, yeah. You know? And things turned out okay, you know? Like, I don't know, so somehow, like, drama became the place where I felt like I started to, like, figure out some more experimental ways of approaching literature and making. But then I remember getting to undergrad, and I did a novel independent study with a poetry teacher that I had, because I didn't even think about it. I was just like, I like working with her the most, so I'll ask her to be my my thesis mentor for this project. And she was totally game, but she assigned me a bunch of, like, pretty traditional novels to read together while I was trying to draft a novel. They weren't bad. It was, like, The Corrections and White Teeth, and they were beautiful, you know, but they were the most popular novels at that moment. And at one point I asked her, I said, what's your favorite novel? And she said, David Markson's Wittgenstein's Mistress, which, if you know it, is this very, like, lyric, it's, like, almost, like, reads mostly like a series of facts but also the woman who's telling the story is potentially the last woman on Earth, and she's just sort of wandering the streets and trying to figure out if she is, in fact, the last woman on Earth. And that novel blew my mind open, because I was like, this is a novel? Like, I don't know what to call this, but you're telling me it's a novel? I feel like that was a book that just, like, changed everything for me.
So you're all teachers, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So for your students, and also for everyone here, for all of us to learn, what do you do to encourage them to kind of figure out their intersections or crossroads, or where there's this fluidity that's really beautiful instead of a stark boundary? How do you do that for your students?
I kind of, like, I'm a big believer in asking them what they're into, and then sort of, like, giving them as much of that as I myself am enthusiastic about and love. I found that actually that's weirdly the case, especially when people say they're into science fiction or fantasy or horror, and then I asked them what they love, and they mentioned somebody, and said, well, that person's lovely, but they died, like, 50 years ago, you know, you can't talk to them anymore. And then I just try to compile a list of, like, these are the people I really love right now. This is what they're writing. These are some of their stories. Oftentimes, for a lot of writers, a lot of beginning writers, I think that they're really, they'll go for novels. And so I'll, you know, give them, like, a list of, like, really cool short stories that are like the novel that they love, but that was written, you know, this year or the year before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's, like, one of the places I'd be. And then the more you you're drawing from, the more you can, you know, yeah, find what your intersections are.
Yeah.
I throw a lot, because I come from improv, and I'm from a theater background, we play a lot of games.
Cool.
a lot of games. I do that for writers as well, because I think that it's important to get back to the childlike essence of who we are. And so, you know, we talk a little bit at the top, but then we are doing eye contact games, we're doing sound ball games, you know, I'll throw something out like, woo, and you have to catch, woo, and throw out a new sound like, ah, you know. And so I try to get us out of our heads very, very quickly and into our bodies, and laughing. And in that serves as a diagnostic where I can kind of see, you know, one, it puts us all on the same level of play, and there's no hierarchy in the class. And so then we get to, you know, that serves as a diagnostic where I can just kind of see, like, okay, who's a little bit, you know, inventive, clown-like, maybe a bit more introverted and shy, and then I kind of do a little bit of I customize my classes like a little bit of a prescription on that.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, I you know, I mean, I think that maybe similar to Juan, like when I'm looking at when I'm forming my syllabi, figuring out what they're going to read. I do err on the side of short stories because most of what they can write in their classes, what you can actually fit into getting done in a quarter or on the quarter system, is, you know, a story. And I want them to work on stories because so many of them want to write novels, and I'm all for it. But they're going to do so many of them are doing that on their own, but they've never finished one. And having to write a story from beginning to end and figure out what the full shape of it is, you know, I know that the scale of a novel is very different, right? But it's still, you know, like such a valuable exercise. And so when I'm putting my syllabi together and figuring out what we're going to read together, you know, I try to look at, I try to choose current writers too, because I feel like they're getting a lot of older writers in their literature classes, which they have to take plenty of. Not that there's not so much value in older stories, and sometimes it's older work that's just recently been translated for the first time, and so it's you know, it's in the conversation, because I feel like that's such an important thing for writers that they don't realize is that, you know, it's tough to make your way in the writing world when your only point of reference is James Joyce or Flannery O'Connor or something like that. You know, it's like, it's so helpful when you know who the people are who are out there making work right now. So trying to get as many different perspectives and voices and identities onto the syllabi. onto the syllabi as possible. And stories that are really taking some chances. So I think that ultimately, what I'm maybe trying to do for them is to recreate that moment that I had where I was like, this is a story? Like, what? You know? Because, you know, so often it just seems like it unlocks something for them, and they'll start taking these chances where they thought, oh, okay, it has to be this set of things. And just letting them feel that sense of play, like Diana was saying, and possibility. And, to your question, you know, I mean, I know that everyone knows this text and it's beloved, I think it's beloved for a reason. Like in my in a creative nonfiction class that I was just teaching this week, we were talking about Gloria Anzal Dua's How to Tame a Wild Tongue. And so we were talking about all of the different voices and vernaculars that each of the students has, and all of the different ways that they carry themselves in the world depending on context, and thinking about which one of those do you write from, or all of them, or is it possible to use different ones to write different pieces, and what does that do for the work? And yeah.
So a twist on the what are you working on now question is, for me, what intersections or mysteries in our present reality are inspiring you? And what are you creating from that inspiration?
I'm really growing more and more obsessed with, I think it was always there, but like affluence and inequality and the ways in which those seem to be deranging in some ways. Like they seem to shift reality so intensely for people, and not just the Kardashians, even though the new season on Hulu is like a...
Exceptional.
It's delicious. But it's like this bouquet of cognitive dissonance, right? Yeah. Like there's just a bunch of like, why are you walking in black leotards all the time?
Yes.
You know, why is there a buffet table at your kitchen? And it's
chef?
So it's, so that's, and complicity, right? Those three things together are things that I'm really kind of finding that kind of go to.
I'm doing a lot on visibility and inclusion, this idea of being seen. So a lot of my work is kind of focusing on that and not seen. I think the huge part that I'm finding, just because there's so much that happened with the pandemic and there's so much around of marginalized voices and not being seen, not being heard, and a lot of it for me, it focuses is to turn it inward and to first see ourselves before we're waiting or expecting others to see us. And I think the huge thing, I know it's so outwardly focused, I want to be seen, I want to be seen, I want to be seen, but for me, it's all about seeing yourself first in the world. And so how does that show up when, how do you navigate and live your life by seeing yourself fully?
Mine feels maybe related to what Juan was talking about. I have this project that I've been working on for a long time, and I don't know when it will feel like it's ready for the world, or maybe if ever. But it's this project where I record every like transaction that I have, where it's like where every trip to the grocery store or every like exchange of goods or money or services, and observations that I make like during those actions too. And it was something that I started, I mean, I've probably been working on it for like 6 years now. But it was, you know, like what it was highlighting was the way in which as people consume more and more via online shopping and ordering and delivery and things like that, the way that that relationships between human beings are breaking down. And then the pandemic happened, and I was like, well, now this feels obvious, you know? Like, now everybody's thinking about what it means to just be in your home and not want to have to call to order dinner even. You know, you only want to be able to do it if you can order it on a phone or something, you know? I don't know. Now I feel like everything that I sort of thought I understood about that project from just like a late stage capitalism perspective has changed because of our existence in the world has changed so drastically and so quickly. So I think it'll be a long time before I figure out what that means for turning that into. At the time, I thought it was going to become some sort of speculative novel where a person slowly like disappeared as they were interacting less and less with the environment around them. But now my experience of the pandemic and people's attempts to kind of crawl out of it and figure out life again is changing what that narrative feels like to me.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, thank you all so much for your questions, for your presence, and thank you so much to our panelists.
You
are brilliant.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, sex and relationship columnist Zachary Zane discusses his new collection, Boy Slut, a memoir and manifesto. Now go. Be inspired and find the mind of a writer in yourself.